This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Thursday, December 13th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. Yesterday, conservative lawmakers in Great Britain voted to keep the embattled Prime Minister, Theresa May, in power. The vote came after 2 years of raucous infighting within her party and growing discontent among voters about Britain's exit from the European Union. The deadline for withdrawal is only 3 months away, and May lacks parliamentary support for her plan. She's promised to step down before the next election in 2022. After surviving the no-confidence vote, she addressed reporters outside her office in London.
A significant number of colleagues did cast a vote against me, and I've listened to what they said. Following this ballot, we now need to get on with the job of delivering Brexit for the British people and building a better future for this country. A Brexit that delivers on the vote that people gave, that brings back control of our money, our borders and our laws, that protects jobs, security and the union, that brings the country back together rather than entrenching division. That must start here in Westminster.
Sam Knight joins me from London to discuss the crisis in Great Britain and how it relates to the political turmoil across Europe. Sam, welcome back.
Hello.
So I was just recalling this morning that Theresa May initially opposed Brexit, which meant that she's had to convince, really has had to sell a Brexit deal that she never really believed was in the best interest of the country. How did the UK get to this point?
Yeah, no, that's really since sort of the last days of Margaret Thatcher, sort of the late 1980s, there'd been a small vocal minority in the Conservative Party that were convinced that Britain's membership of the European Union was holding the country back, opening it up to unlimited migration from other countries in Europe, and stopping Britain really being, in their eyes, a kind of free trading, more Atlantic facing nation. And this sort of grew and grew and grew as the EU integrated during the, you know, financial crisis in 2008. And it was responsible for the growth of UKIP and the, you know, other kind of right-wing forces in British politics. So David Cameron announced this referendum to put this question to bed. And so therefore, when the referendum happened in 2016, the cabinet was given a choice. They could campaign for in or out, but really the most mainstream, sensible politicians campaigned for in because it was the rational, sensible thing to do. And Theresa May is nothing if not all of those things. So she weighed in on the Remain side, although, you know, May was a pretty quiet presence during the referendum campaign, even though she could have had quite a significant voice as the Home Secretary. But nonetheless, when this, you know, truly shocking result happened in 2016 and Cameron resigned, there was this kind of terrible squabble among the Brexiteers who were as astonished as anybody that they had won the referendum too. And May was clearly the kind of figure in the party who people could rally around. But from day one, she had to establish her credentials as someone who would deliver this extraordinary policy that she'd never campaigned for. So the last 2 years of her premiership, there has been this sort of constant pressure on her to placate the winners of the referendum and also to be seen to deliver Brexit, which is why she, you know, she says that whenever she opens her mouth, pretty much.
It just seems like a completely impossible position for her to be in. I have to say my heart goes out to her. You know, she, as you say, she's not a particularly exciting leader, but she is committed to getting this done. And she's really been extremely careful about trying to iron out all the difficult policy details, campaign tirelessly for it. What are the big sticking points here?
Well, I think you're completely right in that. And in a strange way, in these desperate last few weeks, her stock has sort of never stood higher on the sort of general sympathy vote in terms of this is a devoted, diligent, intelligent, selfless person trying to square a very, very difficult circle. I mean, I think that kind of overlooks some of the missteps that she made initially framing Brexit, which has led her to be in the situation that she's in at the moment. But the crucial sticking points at this moment This is this thing that everybody talks about, and it sort of comes up, and I'm again, it's called the backstop, the dreaded Irish backstop.
Yes, I tell you, this is one of the things that Americans do not understand. So explain the backstop.
I mean, the backstop is rapidly becoming, you know, like the Schleswig-Holstein affair, you know, three people ever understood it and two of them are dead or something like that. You know, the backstop is this obscure thing, but I'll explain it as best as I can. Basically, it works like this. When I talk to EU people, they say that in order to make any future relationship with the UK, the first thing that you have to do is arrange the divorce, the floor for any future agreements. If the UK leaves and then we can never agree a future treaty, there is this thing called the backstop. There is this fail-safe that we can fall back on. And the backstop is particularly contentious about the border between Ireland and Northern Ireland, which if Britain leaves the EU, it kind of logic dictates that that will be the new external border of the EU with the UK. Therefore, you would have to have some kind of border. But both sides adamant that there shouldn't be any kind of border. All these sort of terrible reminders of the troubles. And so in order to get around this problem, they've come up with this thing, which is that the UK would stay within the EU's customs union until we can agree something better to replace them with, a kind of bespoke trading agreement, if you like.
Boy, now I sympathize with her even more. It's just such a nightmare. So just pulling back a little bit, you mentioned briefly, you know, the austerity politics introduced under May's predecessor, David Cameron, after the financial crisis. It seems pretty clear from over here that that isn't working. And I wondered what pro-Brexit working class voters are now saying. I know you've talked to people in various towns which are going to suffer from Brexit.
Yeah, I mean, Brexit is a terrible remedy for a lot of people who voted for it. You know, I remember distinctly getting the ballot paper through the post in 2016, and the options were, do you want to stay in the EU or do you want to leave? And it was basically a choice between, do you want to change everything or do you want to leave it how it is? It was one option for the status quo and one just to shake the tree, you know? And so as soon as I saw that ballot paper, I was like, people are going to go for this. But it will have negative economic effects. And really, no one disagrees with that. All of the government's own forecasts show that this is going to make Britain a poorer place. And after 8 years of austerity and cuts to government services and benefits and things like that, that will hit the working poor. They will suffer after this.
So in the meantime, the Labour Party seems to be moving in for the kill. Tell us about Jeremy Corbyn, effectively Britain's Bernie Sanders, who I believe not so long ago was something of a joke. And now it doesn't seem impossible that a Labour Party could come to power.
It's more probable than at any point since 2010, really. Jeremy Corbyn has long been a critic of the European Union, but sort of rather confusingly, not from the right, but from the left, regarding it as a trading bloc for big European companies. So Labour right now are divided over Brexit, not as much and not as kind of painfully and not as obviously as the Conservatives, but right now they're benefiting from the spotlight being firmly on the Conservative Party and Theresa May's handling of this. And also, they can smell power. They can smell the chaos that this is causing. The Labour Party, more than at any previous point under Corbyn, is disciplined and organized because they sense that just a few more missteps and, you know, it's likely that we will have, you know, Prime Minister Jeremy Corbyn, which is, you know, genuinely unthinkable.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
So elsewhere in Europe, there's also great discontent with the EU and the Yellow Vest Revolt in Paris against President Emmanuel Macron has been unfolding for a month. I saw a recent poll that showed 70% of voters in France disapprove of the EU. And I wondered how you would characterize this backlash.
Well, I think that's really, really interesting. And I think it's something that people speed past. I mean, the EU is an astonishing economic and political project that started after the Second World War. And it lacks democratic legitimacy. There's no two ways about that. You can think it's a brilliant kind of civilizing project for Europe, or you can think it's some, you know, horrendous federal sort of super state. But there's no question that voters don't like it. And when they get a chance to express their views about it, they are negative. You know, the Danes rejected the European Union in 1992, they were persuaded to change their minds in 1993. The EU Constitution, the last time they put that to voters in France and the Netherlands in 2005, both countries voted against it. Ireland voted against the EU Constitution in 2008, 2009. You know, whenever you have an election or a referendum like the Brexit vote in 2016, it tends to go against the EU because it's so easy to characterize it as this alien, remote system, which basically benefits large companies and elites and in that way. So it always loses in a yes or no debate.
So you have the sort of rise of the left, as we've just been discussing, with the Labour Party becoming stronger. And you also have elsewhere in Europe the rise of the far right.
These are populists beating the same drum. And I think it's something that's sometimes lost in the UK when we consider our situation, that when you're sitting in Brussels and you're looking out over Europe and you're looking at all these different threats and challenges, of which migration is the kind of the central one, often kind of migrants from outside the European Union entering to the continent and then how they move around inside that, you sense an enormous instability, which, you know, frankly, isn't helped by President Trump taking a swing at the European Union kind of every few weeks. So there is this sense of an embattled bloc in which Brexit happens to be the current kind of scenario in which this being played out most explicitly. But there's definitely a sense of European leaders trying to hold it together. And that sort of plays into a narrative in the UK of whether we're being punished to sort of discourage other countries and other populations from voting against it or trying to leave.
So tell us what happens now in Great Britain. May's survival of the no confidence vote seems like a Pyrrhic victory. So what are the best scenarios and the worst scenarios?
I'm pleased you asked that question. No one knows what's going to happen now. I mean, we are in a sort of a genuinely kind of hard to predict phase. I'll give it my best shot. May won the confidence vote last night, but 117 of her own MPs voted for her to no longer be the leader of the party, which is a much higher number than most people were expecting. So she really was kind of bloodied by this. What is going to happen now is that Theresa May is on this kind of frantic tour around Europe begging for changes to the deal that she struck with the European Union in November. The European Union is currently making a great display of how it won't make any changes. So it's likely that Theresa May is going to return to Parliament in January with some token revision or change to her deal. And right now, from where we're sitting, it seems highly unlikely that she'll be able to get it through the House of Commons. We are deadlocked. And that then leads to sort of questions of what will happen next. And over the last few weeks, there's been sort of rapidly increasing talk in London of the possibility of some kind of second referendum, because it's going to be very, very difficult to get something solid agreed by Parliament in time for March the 29th, which is the departure date.
So it is possible that there would be another referendum and that Britain would vote to stay in the EU after all of this?
Well, there will then be a frantic argument about what the choice will be on the ballot paper. I mean, something that's easy to lose sight of is that May is being continually attacked and ambushed by the right wing of her party, which basically last night produced this 117 votes against her, which is impressive, but it's only 117 out of 650 MPs. So the hardcore Brexiteer, let's leave without any deal at all, Britain will be fine, they'll blink first, that really is a small minority of the House of Commons. So I think what will happen in January, she will return with this deal and fail, but that larger will of the House of Commons and Labour will, I think, begin to sort of steer the process towards a second referendum or some kind of even closer relationship to the EU than May's deal.
Because if Britain leaves without any clear deal, which is also a possibility, correct, that would lead to complete chaos.
I mean, it is the most frightening scenario, and it's actually the only one that currently exists. You know, the actual legal steps have been taken for Britain to leave, but the legal step for Britain to leave with an agreement with the EU does not currently exist. So the default option, the do-nothing option, is that at 11 p.m. London time on March 29th next year, Britain leaves the European Union, its closest economic and political and security partner for the last 45 years, with no existing piece of paper between them. It really is a kind of an unthinkable sort of state for a supposedly kind of advanced country like this one to find itself in.
Thanks so much, Sam.
Nice to talk to you, Dorothy. Thank you.
Sam Knight is a staff writer based in London. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review The Political Scene on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program is produced by Alex Barron and Hannah Wilentz for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.